Part 1. Roubaix's Garrote. February 1989. Washington, D.C. Chapter 4. There was nothing unusual about the man slouched in the back seat of a nondescript Ford sedan driving slowly through the streets of Washington. To the pedestrians who scurried in front of the car at stoplighted intersections, he might have been a paper salesman being driven to work by his nephew. No one paid the slightest notice to the White House tag on the license plates. Alan Mercier was a plump, balding character with a genial Falstaff face that masked a shrewd, analytical mind. No clothes horse, he was addicted to ever-rumpled, bargain-priced suits with white linen handkerchiefs stuffed sloppily in the breast pocket. They were trademarks that political cartoonists exaggerated with keen enthusiasm. Mercier was no paper salesman. Recently appointed national security advisor to the country's new president, he was still unrecognized in the public eye. Widely respected in the academic community, he had built a reputation as a canny forecaster of international events. At the time he came under the eye of the president, he was director of the World Crisis Projection Commission. Perching a pair of Ben Franklin specs on a bubble nose, he laid a briefcase across his lap and opened it. The underside of the lid held a visual display screen, and a keyboard console, bordered by two rows of colored lights, lay across the bottom. He typed out a combination of numbers and waited a brief moment while the signal was bounced by satellite to his corner office at the White House. There, a computer, programmed by his aides, whirred into life and began relaying his workload for the day. The incoming data arrived in code and was electronically deciphered in milliseconds by the battery-operated microprocessor on his lap, the final text reading out in green lowercase letters across the screen. First came the correspondence, followed by a series of memos from his Security Council staff. Next came the daily reports from various governmental agencies, the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the Director of Central Intelligence. He quickly digested them to memory before erasing their contents from the microprocessor's storage unit. All except two. He was still lingering over them when his car swung through the west gate of the White House. His eyes mirrored a curious perplexity. Then he sighed, pressed the off button, and closed the case. As soon as he arrived in his office and settled behind his desk, he dialed a private number at the Department of Energy. A man's voice answered in the middle of the first ring. Dr. Klein's office. This is Alan Mercier. Is Ron available? There was a slight pause, and then the voice of Dr. Ronald Klein, Director of Energy, came on the line. Morning, Alan. What can I do for you? I wonder if you could spare me a few minutes today. My schedule is pretty tight. This is important, Ron. You name the time. Klein wasn't used to being pushed, but the cement tone of Mercier's voice implied the security advisor was not about to be put off. He held his palm over the phone's mouthpiece while he checked with his administrative assistant. Then he came back on the line. How does between 2:30 and 3 sound? No problem, replied Mercier. I have a lunch meeting at the Pentagon, so I'll swing by your office on the way back. You did say it was important. Let's put it another way, Mercier said, pausing for effect. After I ruin the President's Day, I'm going to screw up yours. In the Oval Office of the White House, the President sat back from his desk and closed his eyes. He allowed his mind to wander from the pressures of the day for a minute or two. For a man who had been inaugurated to the nation's highest office only a few weeks before, he looked overly worn and tired. The election campaign had been long and exhausting, and he had yet to fully recover from it. He was small in stature, with brown hair streaked with white and thinning. His features, once cheerful and crinkling, were set and solemn. He reopened his eyes as a sudden winter sleet wrapped the floor-to-ceiling windows behind him. Outside on Pennsylvania Avenue, the traffic crawled at a sloth-like pace as the pavement turned to ice. He longed for the warmer climate of his native New Mexico. He wished he could escape on a camping trip to the Sangre de Cristo Mountains near Santa Fe. This man had never set out to become president. Never driven by blind ambition, he had served in the Senate during 20 years of conscientious effort and a solid record of accomplishments that did little toward making him a household name. Nominated as a dark horse by his party's convention, He was elected by a wide popular margin when an investigative reporter dug up a series of shady financial dealings in his opponent's past. "Mr. President?" He looked up from his reverie at the sound of his aide's voice. "Yes?" "Mr. Mercier is here for your security briefing." "All right, send him in." Mercier entered the room and seated himself across the desk. He passed over a heavy folder. "How goes the world today?" the president asked with a thin smile. "Pretty grim, as always," replied Mercier. "My staff has completed the projections on the nation's energy reserves. The bottom line isn't exactly encouraging." "You're not telling me anything I didn't know. What's the latest outlook?" "The CIA gives the Middle East another 2 years before their fields scrape bottom. That will leave the world's known oil supply at less than 50% of demand. The Russians are hoarding their depleted reserves, and the Mexican offshore bonanza fell short of expectations. And as for our own oil deposits, I've seen the figures," replied the president. "The hectic exploration several years ago brought in a few small fields at best." Mercier surveyed the interior of a folder. "Solar radiation, windmills, electric autos, they're partial solutions of a sort. Unfortunately, their technology is at about the same state as television during the 1940s. A pity the synthetic fuel programs got off to such a slow start. The earliest target date before the oil shale refineries can take up the slack is 4 years away. In the meantime, American transportation is up the polluted creek without locomotion." The president cracked a faint smile at Mercier's rare display of dry humor. "Surely there is some hope on the horizon. There's James Bay, the Canadian power project." Mercier nodded and reeled off the statistics. 18 dams, 12 powerhouses, a workforce of nearly 90,000 people, and the rechanneling of two rivers the size of the Colorado. And as the Canadian government literature states, the largest and most expensive hydroelectric project in the history of man. "Who operates it?" "Quebec Hydro, the provincial power authority. They began work on the project in 1974. The price tag has been pretty hefty, $26 billion, the major share coming from New York money houses." "What's the output?" "Over 100 million kilowatts, with double that coming in the next 20 years. "How much flows across our borders?"
"Enough to light 15 states.
The president's face tensed. "I don't like being so heavily dependent on Quebec for electricity. I'd feel more secure if our nation's power came from our own nuclear plants." Mercier shook his head. "The sad fact is our nuclear facilities provide less than a third of our requirements." "As usual, we dragged our feet," the president said wearily. "The lag was partly due to escalating construction costs and expensive modifications," Mercier agreed. "Partly because the demands on uranium have put it in short supply. And then, of course, there were the environmentalists." The president sat in thoughtful silence. "We banked on endless reserves that do not exist," Mercier continued. "And while our country consumed itself into a corner, the neighbors to the north went ahead and did something about it. We had no option but to tap their source."
"Are their prices in line?"
Mercier nodded. "The Canadians, bless their souls, have kept rates on a par with our own power companies. A glimmer of sunshine, after all."
"There's a catch."
The president sighed. "We have to face the unpleasant fact," Mercier went on, "that Quebec expects to pass a referendum for full independence by summer. Prime Minister Sarveau has slammed the door on the Quebec separatists before. You don't think he can do it again?"
"No, sir, I don't.
Our intelligence sources claim that Premier Guerrier of the Parti Québécois has the votes to make it stick next time around."
"They'll pay a high price to break away from Canada," the president said. "Their economy is already in chaos."
"Their strategy is to rely on the United States to prop up their government."
"And if we don't?"
"They can either raise electrical rates to an outrageous level or pull the plug," Mercier answered. "Guerrier would be a fool to shut off our power. He knows we'd retaliate with massive economic sanctions." Mercier stared grimly at the president. "Might take weeks, even months, before the Quebecers felt the pinch. In the meantime, our industrial heartland would be paralyzed."
"You paint a bleak picture." That's only the background scene. You're familiar, of course, with the FQS. The president winced. The so-called Free Quebec Society was an underground terrorist movement that had assassinated several Canadian officials. What about them? A recent CIA report claims they're Moscow-oriented. If they somehow gained control of the government, we'd have another Cuba on our hands. Another Cuba, the president repeated in an expressionless tone. One with the capacity to force America to its knees. The president rose from his chair and walked to the window, staring at the sleet building on the White House grounds. He was silent for nearly half a minute. Finally, he said, "We cannot afford a power play by Quebec, especially in the months ahead." He turned and faced Mercier, his eyes grieved. "This country is broke and up to its ears in hock, Allen, and just between you and me and these walls, it's only a matter of a few years before we have no choice but to cut the stalling and declare national bankruptcy." Mercier sagged into his chair. For a heavy man, he appeared curiously hunched and shrunken. "I'd hate to see that occur during your administration, Mr. President." The president shrugged resignedly. "From Franklin Roosevelt on, every chief executive has played a game of tag, pinning a multiplying financial burden on the office of his successor. Well, the game is about to be called, and I'm it. If we lost electrical power to our northeastern states for 20 days or longer, the repercussions would be tragic. My deadline for the announcement of a new deflated currency would have to be drastically reduced. I need time, Allen, time to prepare the public and the business community for the axe. Time to make the transition to a new money standard as painless as possible. Time for our shale refineries to halt our dependence on foreign oil. How can we restrain Quebec from doing anything foolish? I don't know. Our choices are limited. There are two options when all else fails, Mercier said, a thin line of tension forming around his mouth. Two options as old as time to save an economy from sinking down the drain. One is to pray for a miracle. And the second? Provoke a war. At precisely 2:30 in the afternoon, Mercier entered the Forrestal building on Independence Avenue and took the elevator to the seventh floor. Without fanfare, he was ushered into the plush office of Ronald Klein, the Secretary of Energy. Klein, a scholarly-looking man with long white hair and a large condor nose, unwound his slim 6-feet-5-inch frame from one end of a littered conference table and came over to shake Mercier's hand. "So, what's this matter of dire importance?" asked Klein, skipping the cordial small talk. "More odd than dire," replied Mercier. "I ran across a request from the General Accounting Office for data concerning the expenditure of $680 million in federal funding for the development of a doodlebug."
"A what?"
"Doodlebug," answered Mercier matter-of-factly. "That's a pet name given by geological engineers to any offbeat tool that's supposed to detect underground minerals."
"What's it got to do with me?"
"The money was earmarked for the Energy Department 3 years ago. There's been no accounting of it since. It might be wise to have your staff make a probe as to its whereabouts. This is Washington. Mistakes of the past have a nasty habit of falling on the heads of current office holders. If the former energy secretary blew a staggering sum of money on a white elephant, you'd better be prepared with the facts in case some freshman congressman gets it in his head to grab headlines with an investigation."
"I'm grateful for the warning," Klein said sincerely. "I'll get my people busy sweeping the closets."
Mercier rose and extended his hand. "Nothing is ever simple." "No," Klein said, smiling, "it's never that." After Mercier left, Klein walked over to a fireplace mantel and stared idly at a new log on the soot-coated grate, head bent, hand shoved in the side pockets of his coat. "How incredible," he murmured to the empty room, "that anyone can lose track of $680 million.